The last 2 weeks, we've been looking at the story of King Solomon through the early chapters of the Book of Kings. And it's dramatic, and it's just great storytelling, so it sort of does its own work, and there's a lot to dig into there. I ultimately wanted to use some of the books, the wisdom of Solomon, the books attributed to Shlomo HaMelech, as a way of looking back at his legacy. And I'm especially, next week will be our last class, and I'm really gunning for Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, because we're not just looking at the story of King Solomon, we're looking at King Solomon as an embodiment of this virtue that is so paramount in our tradition, this virtue of chokhmah, or wisdom. Though, as I've said every time, I'm also interested in Shlomo, not just as a wise king, but as a brilliant, a kind of genius king, because every time that we've gathered, we've talked about that. Are we talking about intelligence, brilliance, genius, smarts? First of all, there are a lot of words in the Hebrew that we'll be playing with, but Shlomo himself seems to be more than just a sort of an experienced, wise, psychologically insightful person, although he is that. He has unparalleled kind of mega-genius kind of knowledge. So I want to get eventually to Ecclesiastes, which I think is an incredible way of reflecting back on the story that we've been looking at, and is a book that is certainly concerned with the value of and the definition of chokhmah, wisdom. But we're talking about wisdom, and so we really have to spend some time with Mishlei, with the book of Proverbs, because that book is really about wisdom more than any book. If Solomon is the ultimate figure of wisdom, Proverbs is really the book that is about chokhmah almost obsessively. We refer to these books as wisdom literature, but Proverbs especially, Mishlei especially, a mashal is a proverb, is especially about this pursuit of wisdom and what wisdom means and how important it is and how it really is. It starts to seem like the most important virtue of all. And you get the feeling that our rabbis took that to heart, that idea that that wisdom was the most important virtue of all. After all, they called themselves, or they called their teachers, the Chachamim, the wise. That was, and I started this series with a quote from the Talmud, Chacham Adif Mi Navi, a wise person is even better than a prophet. That's quite a thing to say, you know, in this tradition to say, and the folks who are saying it are essentially saying, we're better than prophets, right? Because they're the Chachamim. So Mishlei really sets a tone, sets a kind of, if wisdom is inevitably going to appear on any list of Jewish virtues, this book gets the lion's share of the credit. But it is, I find, if you don't, then great, because I will love your help, I find this to be one of the most difficult books in the Tanakh, in our Bible. This is just, it's very, very hard to get through. If you sat down and tried to read it, which I've done many times, eventually you just have to take a break because it doesn't flow, and it kind of goes around and around and around on the topic of wisdom and on similar themes stated slightly differently every time. And in fact, it's long been studied and commented on in isolated verses. Like this verse, because after all, it's also written in verse, in kind of poetic form. So this verse is like, this is a famous verse, and we'll just sort of like, how does the first part weigh in with the second part? And just to consider that one statement. But once you start reading through, and we've got other books of poetry in our Tanakh, like Tehillim, the Book of Psalms, but Tehillim has a little more like movement to it. There's a little more of a kind of flow to it, whereas Mishlei is really just, it feels like every verse is block by block, just sort of punching your way through it. Or at least I feel that way, and I have a friend who I will not implicate, who feels that way also. He says that Mishle, and he is a real master of Tanakh, but he says Mishle is his least favorite book of the Hebrew Bible. And I think in his case, it's also because, here's another difficult thing about Mishle, is that it's very preachy, very pedantic, very, it's like, tisk, tisk, do this, be, you know, be better, be wise, don't go off, you know, wisdom as opposed to sin, you better not sin, you better be careful. So it's a little bit like heavy-handed, and it's difficult reading. But we have to look at it. I mean, if we're talking about wisdom, we have to look at it. And what I want to do with you tonight is to take one way through, one good way, I think, through this very difficult book, and we've already done the work for it. The one of the best ways, I think, through this book is to see it as it has classically been attributed, which is to see it as Solomon's book, as a book that is, it opens by claiming to be Mishle Shlomo ben David Melech Israel. These are the Proverbs of Solomon ben David, king of Israel. And in fact, we spoke of Solomon as having composed Proverbs. If you look at the first source on your page, this is one of the moments where Solomon gets that immeasurable wisdom. V'yiten Elokim chochma leShlomo. God gave Shlomo chochma, wisdom. And here we start to introduce other words, utvuna, and discernment, understanding. And that word will be in the mix tonight as well. Utvuna harbe me'od v'rochav lev, and a breadth of understanding, really a wideness of heart, because one of the things that we've seen in our last two classes is that what Shlomo asked for was a heart that could hear or understand. God gave him a heart, that a lev chacham, a wise heart. So that word's also in the mix. And then one expression of that is v'yedaber shloshet alafim mashal. He composed 3,000 proverbs. And there's the connection. V'yehi shiro chamisha ve'elef. And his song numbered 1,005. That song also is a little bit of a signal word, because another book that we attribute to Solomon that we won't be looking at much tonight is the Song of Songs. But like, there's the connection. There he is. He composed Proverbs, and he composed 3,000 of them. So it's not so clear. Scholars sort of assume that this is a collection of Proverbs by lots of folks, and in a Solomonic tradition that doesn't exactly track the 3,000 to what we have in our book. But there is some notion that this is what he was up to, and this opening line of Mishle, the Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel, makes it clear that this is how we're being invited to read the book, to read the book as if this was Solomon's, as if this was his reflection, his Proverbs, his wisdom, maybe at the height of his glory, though I want to start to question that as we go, because a lot of the reflections seem like maybe they could be offered as a critique of all that glory. So that's what I'm gonna try to do with you all tonight, is to read sections of Mishle as if they were reflections on the legacy of Solomon. And then Mishle, this difficult book, begins to read a little bit like a midrash, a little bit like a kind of an expansion and a commentary on this epic story of one of our tradition's great legends. And I just want to just remind us of a few key words and moments that do that inviting, that invite us to see Mishle as really connected directly to the story of Shlomo in Sefer Melachim. And then we'll see passages that I think do that again and again in some very direct ways. So first of all, in this first passage from Kings, as we read, God gave Shlomo chochma utfuna, wisdom and discernment, and then he composed Proverbs and songs. I would just add one more word to that will be quickly referenced as we head into Mishle, and that is, if you remember last time, we saw Solomon get a visit from the Queen of Sheba. She was a real Sharpie herself. And she came to him, you'll see in this verse, Umalkat Sheva Shomatet Shema Shlomo. She heard of Solomon's fame, L'shem Hashem, in the name of God. I've never been sure what to do with that phrase. But she heard of his fame, V'tavo L'nasoto B'chidot. She came to test him with chidot, which are like riddles or tricky, you know, puzzles. There's something mysterious about, she would test him. And we talked about that last time, what exactly was going on. But okay, so with all of those just key words in mind, just take a look at the way that Proverbs opens. Mishle Shlomo ben David Melech Yisrael, the Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel, ledat chochma umusar lahavin imre bina, for the knowledge of wisdom and discipline, for understanding words of discernment. So you've got wisdom and discernment. Lahavin mashal umilitza, for understanding proverb and metaphor, divrei chachamim v'chidotam, the words of the wise and their riddles. All right, so there's that word again. It's just sort of like, it seems like a lot of what Shlomo was up to in the Book of Kings we're suddenly now trading in. So there's, like, you can see the way the books are tethered just by those signal words. Now I just want to say a few more things before we head into Mishle, and that is that just by way of introduction, there are a few, although it's a very difficult book, just here in the opening lines we get a few really important basic themes or premises that we can keep in mind as we head into certain sections of Mishle. And one is, we already read this, Ledat Chochma Umusar, to know wisdom and Musar. What's Musar? Translating it as discipline here, but there's like a whole movement, a Musar movement, that's about improving oneself, bettering one's character, and the language is the language of restraint, of really binding oneself and making sure that one is not just smart, but disciplined. And that already tells you a lot about what this book is up to, is to know chokhmah umusar, both things, wisdom, but how to balance wisdom with some kind of self-control. And as I say that, I am asking you to remember just how self-controlled or not Solomon was. We'll remind ourselves of that soon. But yeah, bracha.
Yeah, it's interesting. We get a hint of that in the word chachma, because it also spells koachma. To what purpose is it being used?
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Okay, good. That's like from the Balatanya. I don't know where it starts, but that language of like chachma being the same letters as koachma. What force, what purpose is all of this wisdom? And I think Bracha's right. That little kind of like wordplay drasha is meant to say, what is wisdom worth? What is the purpose of wisdom? And how valuable is wisdom? And are there, I call this series like the power and peril of genius. What is the peril of wisdom? And that is, I think you're right, one of the questions that we'll be asking here. And we'll ask it in some ways, again, in a different way with Kohelet next week, with Ecclesiastes. But by that point, we will have gotten to an entirely different sort of reconsideration of wisdom, whereas Mishle seems to be very much attached to wisdom and it's very important to Mishle that we cultivate wisdom, but this ambivalence that Bracha is suggesting, this uncertainty as to how valuable is wisdom and how valuable is wisdom if it is not constrained in some way. So that pairing of chokhmah and musar is going to be one of the things that repeats itself throughout this book. Yeah.
No, what I just wanted to add was that musar to me is more of like ethics or your personal, almost like your derech eretz, like how you conduct yourself in your life. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that the words that you chose to describe it were self-control.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's an aspect, but it's more, I think for the purposes of Mishle, that it's more about listening to what's inside of you and developing a personal ethic from that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which is why, like, Mishle is a book of interest to people who study, like, biblical studies. It's like a lot of dissertations in biblical studies.
Wait, why? Explain that last part. Why does that make it such a point of interest for the scholars?
Because it's less about a transcendent God and meddles in human affairs, and it's more about...
You got to work on yourself. Right, right, good.
That's also why it's the favorite book of the religious right. So,
well, and why it becomes a favorite book of this tradition that borrows its name from that word, the Musar tradition.
Yep.
Right? This is in some ways the beginning of the Musar tradition, which, as you're framing it interestingly, is, although God will come up again and again, yes, is like some, like raises some question of, well, okay, but how are you going to better yourself? And not just follow the way of the Lord, but actually to work on yourself. And that, asking that question is important with Shlomo, because that is one of the questions, is how bound is he to God and God's discipline, and how much self-control did he have, or how much personal reflection did he have in his own actions? Okay, so one thing to keep in mind is musar, kind of discipline. The other thing to keep in mind, and here's another kind of famous phrase that appears even more famously in the Book of Psalms, but repeats itself again and again in Mishlei as well. Yirat Hashem reshit dat chokhma u'musar evilim bazu. The fear of the eternal is the beginning of knowledge. The fear of the eternal. Reshit chokhma yirat Hashem is how it says in Psalms. But this idea that, alongside what you just said, that actually it isn't just about you, but somehow your awareness. What does it even mean to say, let's just stop there for a second. What does it mean to say that the beginning of wisdom or the beginning of knowledge is the fear of God? What is meant by that?
It means step one, like the basics.
Okay. And what's step one? Anyone?
Like, yeah. Understanding there's an ultimate source from which everything comes, and that is the logic which orients the world.
Good.
And that it's not you.
And that it's not you. Good. Okay, so all of this. So wisdom is something that could be cultivated outside of that kind of awareness. In fact, maybe that's part of worry about with Shlomo. But true wisdom requires your own mental capacity, your own turning in, but it isn't enough. You have to have some awareness of the source of it all, and in particular, the great starring character in our Bible, God. You have to have some reverence for, some fear, some awareness. And fear here is, I think, an appropriate word, another kind of restraint that might temper your inclinations, another way of counterbalancing chokhmah, okay? And then the last thing that I just want to point out as kind of a theme that gets set that I think is important to return to is the next line here, Shma b'ni musar avicha va'al titosh torat imecha. Listen, my son, to the musar, that discipline, of your father, va'al titosh, and don't forsake torat imecha, the instruction, or maybe the Torah, of your mother. Those are interesting characters to introduce into our discussion. The parents of, well, whose parents exactly? I mean, it is presented as if the mother or the father were doing the talking, but I want to consider also the possibility that the author of Mishlei is remembering his own father and mother, right? And we've already evoked one of the fathers in this scene, right? Solomon's father was David, and Solomon's mother was Bathsheba, okay? Now, those are figures I want us to just keep in mind. David, who was, if Solomon is kind of like the second greatest of the kings of Israel, David is certainly remembered as the greatest. And Bathsheba is an interesting figure too, because she, in a way, is the object of David's great sin, David's great fall or failure, which is that he coveted her, took her, and then had her husband killed. Yeah. So she is not herself culpable, but she is implicated in the failing of the father, and yet she gives birth to the next king. Okay, so she's also hovering. Yeah, I'm just going to start standing up because I can't see everyone. But she's also going to be a figure that I want us to hold on to, that we'll sort of return to by the end here, the figure of Bathsheba. Yeah, in the back.
I remember the book, I guess, Torah and Nahalik, specifically the Torah, the instruction of Bathsheba, was that Shlomo should become.
Yeah.
So we're first class. Like, it was her, her out of her instruction that really, like, puppet mastered this whole situation with that Shama Shiva Kung King. So, like, it's an interesting, like, I never thought about what it's meaning to have to meet her, but, like, in this case, it might specifically mean the instruction of your mother, meaning that Shama Shiva be here.
Good, good, good. That's a great connection. Thanks for remembering that, because that's a great connection. We saw in our first class that both Batsheva first, actually, in some ways before David, it's a kind of like Rebecca and Isaac scene where she seems to be almost manipulating David into, because David seems unaware of who's becoming king, and she pushes her son, and it's not obvious that Shlomo is going to be the next king. And in fact, Adoniah is ascending to the kingship when she and Natan the prophet move in to make Shlomo the king. And then David does seem to go along with it, and he's also an important figure because then David gives Shlomo all this advice, which includes slaughtering all of their enemies as he comes into power, right? So Batsheva and David, the Musar and the Torah, sounds very nice here, but if we imagine that the author here is Shlomo and that he is remembering his parents, he might be remembering the guile with which Batsheva slid him into power and the savagery with which his father told him to begin that power. Okay, so these are both good reference points. Let's see.
Yeah. So this is the first time I think we've seen Dama introduced.
Mm-hmm.
King's knowledge. And I feel like in the pre-Wikipedia world, like, knowing stuff is, like, pretty important. And it might actually have been viewed as even higher than wisdom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's, okay, good. Thanks for highlighting that one as well, because we have Chochmah, we have Bina, we have Da'at, and now we have Chabad. Chabad, who we've already referenced the Bala Tanya, and let's do it again, because Chabad takes up this trio and creates an entire epistemology around different kinds of knowing. In their scheme and others, Chochmah is more of an intellectual knowing, Bina more of an intuitive knowing, and Da'at more of a practical knowing. That's a very shorthand that doesn't give justice to the complexity of it. But what is important to note is that that triad, that appears already in the Torah, right? In the way that that Moshe is picking judges. That triad as will recur here throughout Mishlei. So the idea that, and maybe there are other words that we can collect as we go along, but specifically when it comes to wisdom, you know, we're talking about the wisdom of Shlomo, which he's most known for, but he was given wisdom and Bina and Da'at, and all of these things are in the mix, and which one of them he mastered and which one he might not have as much is also an interesting way to think about, you know, as we've been thinking about different kinds of wisdom, different kinds of knowledge. Okay. All right, and then just one last thing, and then we'll start to do a little of that kind of like proto-midrashic work. And I do think that that's a good way to think about books of Tanakh in general, is they are in a conversation, a textual conversation, and they are often referring to other books, or at least there is shared language. So Mishlei is a kind of a midrash on Malachim, at least as it's presented to us, and so then would be Song of Songs. And we are not going to spend a lot of time with Song of Songs tonight, but I just want to plant one thing in your brain, and then we'll come back to it hopefully at the end if I do my job, which is just because we're not going to spend much time with Song of Songs because it's not explicitly about wisdom in the way that Mishlei is and in the way that Kohelet certainly touches on in very direct ways. But I just want to just, since we have named Solomon as having written 3,000 proverbs, mashal, and 1,005 songs, shiro, although it's in the singular, his song. Let's just remember that the book of Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim, also opens by attributing itself to Shlomo. Shir HaShirim Asher L'Shlomo, the Song of Songs by Solomon, or dedicated to Solomon. It's always difficult to translate that. And then the first line, I just want to put it in your head. We'll come back to it later. But Yishakeni Minashikos Pihu Kitovim Dodecha Miyayin. Kiss me with the kisses of your mouth, for love is sweeter than wine. Seems to have nothing to do with what we're talking about tonight, but it'll become useful to us later on. Okay, so what are we going to do tonight? Like I said, Mishlei is difficult. It's hard to figure out even where to go and what to talk about. But I want to just do in some ways the most obvious thing after having considered the life of Shlomo, which is to think about what wisdom might have to say about his own life, and especially about his downfall, which we witnessed last week. And let's just remind ourselves, Shlomo was brilliant, and he was regal, and he had a lot of virtues, but what were his great pitfalls? What are the reasons that he fell from glory? What were the main reasons?
Hubris,
for sure. Yeah, and what were the forms of his hubris? So hubris, good. There's some worry that he became too haughty, too self-reliant. And that's a good reference point, because one of the texts we use to think about what he was doing wrong was the text in Deuteronomy that warns a king to keep a Torah by his side all the time in order to avoid rom levavo, so that his heart will not become lifted, proud. Okay, so haughtiness. What were the manifestations, though? Yeah?
Egyptian horses, Midianite wives, and lots of money.
Good. Okay, good. So horses in particular, and I'm just going to combine your first and first, because, yeah, he procured vast amounts of horses. In particular, the problem was that he got them from Egypt, which the Torah, that same section in Deuteronomy, had warned against. Don't go back to Egypt to get horses, because, and it seems to be saying, though you may be amassing your power and resources, you shouldn't do so in a way that returns you to your to the origins of our suffering. And there's some Egyptian connection there that we could think about, but you wasn't supposed to do that. And then I'll fold your third answer into that, which is just another example of the massive amounts of wealth that Solomon had. So much amassing of palatial wealth that he had to have more gold, more silver, more everything. That's part of what he's getting from the Queen of Sheba, is more stuff. And that's part of why he has to violate this law, because he needs more horses, and that's where you get them. So one problem that he has is wealth. So I want us to take a look at wealth as it appears in Sefer Mishlei, and indeed it does. And the second answer that you gave is another big problem, maybe the bigger problem that Shlomo has, which is sex or romance, or I don't know what you want to fill, but he has 1,000 women in his life, and that's quite a lot, and also a violation of that same passage in Deuteronomy that warns against being marbe nashim, having too many wives, again, lest that it distract you and particularly turn you away from God. Okay, so we'll see how that happens. I want to first look at wealth, and in some ways, this is an easier topic to tackle because the things that Mishlei has to say about wealth are not so complicated and not so surprising, but it does have a lot to say about wealth, first of all. That in itself is significant. If you go through Mishlei and look at all the passages that deal with amassing money, gold, silver, just business dealings in general, it's one of the major topics. But I want to, before we think a little bit about what Mishlei has to say about wealth, which maybe we could predict, but is worth reflecting on, I want to just prove, or at least try to make the case, that it is saying something about Shlomo in particular. Okay? And to do that, I want to just remind us again of a place that we've been before. Now, this is the moment at the beginning of the Book of Kings where Shlomo gets that special divine blessing of a wise heart. And in particular, he gets that blessing because God is so pleased that he didn't ask for riches. He didn't ask for riches, and he didn't ask for a long life. And so God is so happy with the idea that what Shlomo asked for was a lev shomea, a listening heart, that he says, "Hine asiti kidvarecha, hine natati lecha lev chacham v'navon." Okay, so then I'm now going to do as you have said. I grant you a wise and discerning heart. There are those two words again of like wisdom and bina here in the form navon. There's never been anyone like you before, nor will anyone like you arise again. Great, He got what he wanted, but now, if you ask for the right thing, you also get everything you didn't ask for. So now, I will also, vagam, also, I will grant you asher lo sha'alta natati lach. I will give you what you didn't ask for. Both osher, gam kavod. Both riches and glory, all your life. Osher and kavod, the like of which no king has ever had. And I will further grant you long life. Im telech bedrachai, if you walk in my ways, lishmor chukai umitzvotai, and observe my rules and my mitzvot, kasher halach David avicha, just as your father did, a reminder about David, ve'arachti et yamecha, then I will extend your days, I will give you long life. That's not so arresting, that's sort of part of what God has already articulated. He's impressed that Shlomo didn't ask for these things. But what I want to just point out here before we look at these passages in depth is that it isn't just wealth that God granted Shlomo. It was gam osher, gam kavod, wealth and glory. And that wealth, the word osher, has appeared many times in Tanakh before this. But osher and kavod together appears for the first time here. And then the next time in Sefer Mishle, and you can just see it here in the bold. I'll read the first one, and then we'll consider a little bit. But I just want to make this point that Mishle, at least as its place, is picking up directly on this particular wealth and glory that Solomon got. Happy is the man who finds wisdom, the man who attains understanding. There are those words again, Chochma Tuvana. Her value in trade is better than silver, her yield greater than gold. She is more precious than rubies. All of your goods cannot equal her. In her right hand, orech yamim b'imina, in her right hand is length of days, bismola osher v'kavod, in her left, riches and honor. And then a famous line, darchecha darchei noam v'chol nintivoteha shalom. And the next line is also famous, Eitz Chaim hi lemachazikim ba. That little trio there of riches, glory, and long days, those are all the things that Shlomo got along with his wisdom. And again, that coupling, Osher v'Kavod, it is a new phrase that was introduced in that moment and then is mentioned here and repeated again, you'll see bolded in Proverbs 8. So that's the case that I want to make, that there's a kind of a dialogue going on between Mishle and the last time that these things were mentioned. I mean, it's enough that the book starts by saying these are the Proverbs of Shlomo, but it seems like there are reference points. There's sort of cues looking backward. Okay, now we'll start doing the real work of the class, which is thinking, what is Mishle saying about wealth? Just to repeat, happy is the man who finds wisdom, the man who attains understanding. Her value in trade is better than silver, her yield greater than gold. She is Yakarahi mipninim. She is more precious than rubies or pearls. All of your goods cannot equal her. In her right hand is length of days, in her left riches and honor. And her ways are pleasant ways, and all her paths are peace. Shalom. Which, if we're really trying to keep drawing, I mean, there's the if you go in my ways, and there's the ways, and then maybe shalom is even that might be a stretch. But shalom and shlomo. I mean, there's a lot of like the echo is strong here. So what are we saying about wealth, and not just wealth, but wealth in the light of wisdom?
When it says halach and king, it's not relating to the Tanakh.
You know, I think, that's a good question.
Because I always thought Drachah Adachinah was about Torah, but actually is it about understanding?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think the temptation that our tradition has had our rabbis in particular, who so loved wisdom, is to read every chokhmah here as basically Torah. So that every time we mention chokhmah, it's like we're talking about Torah, but it is, in the text itself, it's a reference to chokhmah. You asked whether it was also a reference to tvunah, and we did mention both of those things, but my sense is that it's wisdom that we are personifying here. And that, I mean, it works in the grammar such that it, feminine, is wisdom, but I think as we'll see as we go, that wisdom is soon to become, and even more so in the next passage, soon to become kind of like a figure, and so she provides all these things, but it's a good question, but we come to speak of it as explicitly Torah, and Torah is mentioned, but it's really wisdom that is the star of the show. Okay.
Okay, so
Mishle
is
All right, yeah, bracha.
This is a stretch because it's not from this period, but I'm thinking of the Kabbalistic notion of the Sfirot and the right being chesed and the left being gvura. So it's interesting that it plays out like that, because then the left would be more of a constraint and a holding back in terms of the wealth and the honor.
Yeah, that's interesting. If we were going to follow that path down, Kabbalah path, yeah, we might say that it is a chesed that you get long life, and then osher and kavod represent some kind of power. But that the image alone is striking, that wisdom or understanding, or it has these things. Like I said, this is less of a complex messaging than we'll soon get to when we think about Michelet's take on sexuality. But just when we come to wisdom itself, on the one hand, it seems fairly straightforward, like wisdom's even better than riches. But what is it saying about riches? Is it that wisdom brings riches, or that it is riches? Because it seems like you could read either thing here. Her value, ki tov sachra mischar kesef, her trade is better than silver. But on the other hand, she's holding osher v'kavod. She brings that with her. So what do you think we're saying here about wealth? What is the relationship between wealth and wisdom? Yeah.
It takes discernment and wisdom to know what to do with your wealth. And this may be a call that I'm giving you this, because you've got all of these other traits, that you would know how to distribute it, or maybe how to take care of other people.
Okay, good. That's a great illustration. And I just, like, at the core of what you're saying is that, oh, Solomon got wealth, but he only got it because he asked for wisdom. And so the two are supposed to be coupled. They're supposed to be acting in some kind of relationship here. And so it is when she's got wealth and glory in her left hand. Well, okay, she's wisdom. What is she doing with that wealth? And can you use your wealth wisely? And did Shlomo use his wealth wisely? These are the sorts of questions that, yes, I think are emerging from this. Other thoughts on the relationship between wealth and wisdom?
Well, I think it's exactly true, but it seems to suggest that wisdom is the precursor to gaining wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a necessary prerequisite.
Right.
I think we know in life there are plenty of people who are incredibly intelligent. And in some ways, going back to what you said earlier, like, they're too intelligent to go into finance or law, so they become college professors.
Uh-huh. Money. Yeah.
And then on the other hand, there are people who are, you know, maybe really good at investing or starting a business of some kind or developing an app that people want, but they're not actually wise in traditional ways that we would imagine.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, we can decouple these things, and I might expect that we would or should. So, like, the idea maybe is that the true wealth is wisdom, right? It's more precious, and maybe you should be content being a college professor. I'm thinking of my friend who doesn't like this book, who is a college professor, but maybe that's why he doesn't like it. But there's a way of being wise with your money, with your investments, and maybe that's a different guy. You could have a certain knowledge that maybe is not going to lead you to riches and glory, and that might be good too. Maybe that's part of what we're saying. But on the other hand, maybe the fullest wisdom would come along with these things, would foster these things, would build these things, and maybe then it would be used to good purpose as well. Okay, let me just give you a little more language here, and we're not going to spend all our time on wealth, but just as one of the things that I think Michelet is reflecting back on. And here you can see, Jody, where wisdom really becomes a person. This is really like an explicit personification. Ani chochma, I, wisdom. I, wisdom, live with prudence, shachanti arama, vedat mizimot emtza, and I attain knowledge and foresight. To fear the eternal, there it is, yirat Hashem, snoat ra, is to hate evil. I hate pride, arrogance, the evil way, and duplicity in speech. Li eitza v'toshia, ani bina li gvura. Mine are counsel and resourcefulness. I am understanding and courage. It translates as courage, but more like power is mine. And now this is interesting. Bi malachim yimlochu. Through me, kings reign and rulers decree just laws. Through me, princes rule great men and all the righteous judges. Okay. So there's a reference to how wisdom might be affecting kings. Those who love me, I love, and those who seek me will find me. And here's that phrase again. Usher v'kavoditi. Riches and honor belong to me. Hon atek v'utzdaka. Enduring wealth and success. My fruit is better than gold, fine gold, and my produce better than choice silver. I walk on the way of righteousness, on the paths of justice. I endow those who love me with substance. I will fill their treasuries. That's some language there. V'otzrotehem amale. I will fill their treasury. So now again, will wisdom make you rich? Is that the idea? Or no, I am better than that. There's still, I think, a little bit of ambiguity here. What is the relationship between wisdom and wealth?
The usage of your wealth, very similar to what you said.
Yeah.
Because in Judaism, wealth is praised, provided that you do good with your wealth. It's not Christian in the sense of wealth is evil. On the contrary, if you are able to do good, well, it's praised. So that's the beginning of the wisdom. It's like an objective. Get wealthy because you will be able to get to do more good.
Yeah, good. Okay. Yeah, I think that's right, that wealth is not being condemned here. It may be later when we get to Ecclesiastes, but it is not being condemned here, but there is no question whether it's that wisdom leads to wealth or whether that wisdom is actually real wealth and wealth doesn't matter. One way or another, it is clear that wisdom is more important than wealth and is a safeguard to the perils of wealth, to problems of wealth, to the excesses of wealth. And again, it's like think about Solomon and how he might have safeguarded. I mean, this guy was the wisest of all men. There'd never been anyone like him. How did he mess up? How is he the one that got too many horses? Okay. All right. So that's wealth. And I hope I've made the case that Mishle seems to have an eye looking back at Shlomo's life here in that aspect. But there is an even stronger metaphor that is coursing throughout Mishle. In fact, it's one of the most arresting things in what I've called this very difficult book. But there are scene after scene of this very strange and kind of airy almost metaphor of this woman that keeps coming for you. And we have to remind ourselves before we go there. I mean, it's almost like, it's almost too overemphasized. Like, who is this woman? Why is she so enticing? And what is it that she is leading you to do? And that's what I hope we'll spend most of the rest of our time wondering about. But let's just remind ourselves of Shlomo's real downfall. Right? His real, which, you know, we got a hint of it when he went and got horses from Egypt. But I don't know, did it seem like that big a deal? I almost didn't notice, but it was a violation of the Torah's warning. But here's where it really goes off the rails, right? This moment we saw last time. King Solomon loved many foreign women. Vamelech Shlomo ahav nashim nochriot rabot, many foreign women. In addition to Pharaoh's daughter, all of the nations that you're not supposed to commingle with, and such Solomon clung to and loved, and here's just the number, he had 700 royal wives and 300 concubines, and his wives turned his heart away. I must say that I just to celebrate this moment that I was hanging out with my partner's younger sister yesterday, and I said I was teaching a class on Solomon, and I was a little bit discreet because she's like 12 years old, and I was like, yeah, it's just about his downfall, and you know, I mean, he really went crazy. I mean, the guy had 700 wives, and she goes, and 300 concubines. impressed. But anyway, so 300 concubines, that's 1,000 all total. And significantly, vayatu nashav et libo, and his wives turned his heart away, which is what Deuteronomy was worried about. They turned his heart away after other gods. He was not wholeheartedly devoted to the eternal as his father David had been. And he followed Ashtaroth, the goddesses of the Phoenicians, and Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. And Solomon did what was displeasing to God and did not remain loyal to God like his father David. As I keep that the image of his father is looming there. And then Solomon built an altar for the god of the Moabites and one for Molech. Molech was actually mentioned in the Torah as don't worship. Solomon built an altar to Molech. This is crazy. And he did the same for Lechol Nashav HaNochriot, for all of his foreign wives. Now, we talked about this last time. We won't rehash it. Just want you to be startled again. And there were interesting thoughts about, what does this mean exactly? Why did he do it? What is the connection between the rampant romance and sexuality with infidelity to God, with idolatry? And there were some interesting thoughts about whether maybe he had to do this in order to create alliances with all these women. It's partly political. But anyway, God said to Solomon, because you are guilty of this and have not kept my covenant and the laws that I have enjoined upon you, I will tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your servants. Just take note that when we begin to encounter this figure of the woman who will entice you, she comes up again and again. I had to decide which passages to select, and I just selected a couple. But take a look at the next piece now from Proverbs. Kitavo chochma belibecha, wisdom will enter your heart. First of all, what did Solomon get? A wise heart. And knowledge will bring you pleasure. Foresight will protect you, and discernment will guard you. Latzilcha mi isha zara minuchriya amreha achalika, to save you from the strange foreign woman from her smooth talk, who forsakes the companion of her youth and disregards the covenant of her God. Her house sinks down to death, and her course leads to the shades. All who go to her cannot return and find again the paths of life. So the strange foreign woman: my son, heed my words and store up my commandments with you. Keep my commandments and live. My teaching is the apple of your eye. Bind them on your fingers. Write them on the tablet of your mind. Really, that's aluach libecha, on the tablet of your heart. I should have retranslated that. Say to wisdom, you are my sister, and call understanding a kinswoman. She will guard you from a strange woman, from a foreign woman whose talk is smooth. Okay, so that was Shlomo's problem, is all of these foreign women. So it isn't just a woman, it isn't just sexuality, it's the metaphor is the foreign woman, the strange foreign woman. And I'll just finish the imagery, and then I want to spend some time figuring out what the heck this means. From the window of my house through my lattice, I looked out and I saw among the simple, noticed among the youths, a lad devoid of sense. He was crossing the street near her corner, walking toward her house. In the dusk of evening, in the dark hours of night, a woman comes towards him dressed like a harlot with set purpose. She is bustling and restive. She's never at home. Now in the square, she lurks at every corner. She lays a hold of him and kisses him. Brazenly, she says to him, I had to make a sacrifice of well-being. Today I fulfilled my vows. Therefore I have come out to you, seeking you, and I have found you. And I have decked my couch with covers of dyed Egyptian linen. I have sprinkled my bed, that should say bed, with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Let us drink our fill of love till morning. Let us delight in amorous embrace. For the man of the house is away, he is off on a distant journey. So what's going on here? This is the metaphor, and I could give you a couple more chapters that returns to it, but the big question is, what is the relationship now between wisdom and enticing sexuality of some sort, but in particular this idea that there's a foreign woman coming from you and wisdom will save you from it. How will wisdom save you from it? Any thoughts on what we're being presented with here?
I see the last line, I think, is call back to King David's downfall.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of the opportunity to do right and wrong, to do it right the second time. The
man of the house is away. He's off on a distant journey. Right. That's an interesting one. Like, is this a reference to David sending Bathsheba's man of the house away off on a distant journey? Right. But it's complicated here, right? Because Mishlei is blaming this strange woman who's there to entice you. But in that case, it's certainly not Bathsheba Uriah's fault. right? It's actually, and similarly, this woman disregards the covenant. But wait a minute, it was Shlomo that disregarded the covenant. So there's like, there's like a displacing of responsibility here, but also like, yes, an evoking of all of the perils that Shlomo, and maybe, yeah, David as well, faced. Yeah, Jody.
It's interesting that the lad that we mentioned is Hasar Lev, like Latin.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like that we just said, it's like Hofma Bili Becha. So it's the fact that like that young person, it's not just that he was young and therefore got saved, it was the fact that he had something missing in his world.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. That's good. Yeah, I was like racing to print these, and I should have retranslated some of this stuff. But yes, that's a good eye to notice that devoid of sense is really chasar lev. He is lacking in heart. And that word is coursing throughout the Solomon story and coursing throughout Mishle as well. And, well, on the one hand, sure, it's a big, big word in our tradition, but it's an important word to think about here because that's what Shlomo was given, was a lev chacham. And lev in ancient Hebrew is the heart, but also the mind. It's sort of the seed of consciousness. And so it functions in both ways. It is the thing which conducts your mental, intellectual faculties, but also the thing that might be drawn in the way that the heart is drawn. Right? They turned his heart away after other gods. So, you know, sometimes we can speak in English or in many, you know, ethical, philosophical traditions of, you know, the temptations of the heart or the body, but the mind has to rule over them. But lev is the seed of all of those things in ancient Hebrew. So there's like a wise heart has to be a heart that is conducting both the intellectual and the amorous and emotional life, in internal life, yeah.
It's interesting that she comes with a set purpose and he's in the process of losing his purpose.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, this is the part that I can't quite make sense of. She's coming for you. She's got an agenda. She's out to get you. They're like, you better watch out. She's lurking on every corner, and she knows how to bring you down. Just like, you know, the Queen of Sheba. How'd she seem to have but she, you know, it gets complicated. I'm not saying it's a one-to-one. Shlomo also, you know, impressed her, but there's a way in which, like, she is going to undermine you, and you are just an idiot on the street corner. Yeah.
Well, the other thing that occurs to me, and I don't have a way of connecting it back to what we're doing, but the other famous foreign woman who seduces a young Israelite man is Potiphar's wife,
mm-hmm.
Yosef.
Mm-hmm.
We read that,
yeah.
That story so well.
Yeah.
But her getting him sent to jail ultimately results in his accession to power.
Right.
So there's something about that. You know, I haven't fully explored it, which is why I didn't say.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good connection. Because Yosef is also someone who is described as Chacham v'Navon.
Yeah.
Right? Not many people are, actually, in our tradition. Bezalel, Yosef, not Moses, right? Interesting. And not David.
Yeah.
But Yosef is, and it's interesting because, you know, on the one hand, he resists her advances, but it ends up getting him married to another Egyptian woman. So here we're talking about sexuality, and someone asked me in one of the classes, like, oh, is it just all women's fault here? Is that really the message here? So that's a critique that we can bring into our discussion. I'm not putting that off the table. But I also think that the woman here is a metaphor for something else. And in Yosef's story, it isn't just the sexuality. It's like the power and the wealth and all of it sort of swirling together to entice you, to bring you away from your home base, your truth, your Torah, your tradition, your father and mother, right? And all of it, you're being drawn away into, because it isn't just that it's a woman, this figure, but also that it's a foreign woman, a strange, someone from outside who's like looking to draw you away from something you're supposed to be attached to. Yeah, Avery.
Along those lines, the madness and parallels to Delilah, Samson.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, and there is a woman who first of all presents Samson with chidot, right? With like riddles. And secondly, yeah, like is a foreign woman who wants to take him away, who wants to draw him away from, and Samson, Yosef resists, but Samson is not a resister, right? Samson is an indulger, and he eats, and he has sex, and he is just like a wild man. And so even though he's bestowed with divine power, there's a way in which like that's another parallel story of like going astray and the lures of, yes, women, but again and again, it's the woman like the Moabite women in the Torah who are like drawing you away, but really trying to draw you towards another god, because that ends up being the problem. The fact that Solomon had 1,000 wives in itself wasn't the problem. It was that he began to build altars for them that, and the complicated way in which like the one pulling of the heart leads to another pulling of the heart, that's part of like the peril here that Mishlei seems to be presenting us with. And what is the solution? How do you safeguard against this? With wisdom. But what does that mean? Wisdom, who, by the way, is another kind of woman, right? So there's the metaphor of the foreign woman, and then there's wisdom, which is also a woman who speaks in a voice and wants you to see her as your sister and a kinswoman, your own kind of woman. So how does that work? Anyone have any sense of how wisdom will safeguard you from these things?
Well, yeah. Complete contrast is the story of Ruth.
Yeah.
Where, if anything, she does the exact opposite.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, say it just one more. How does she do the opposite?
In terms of basically, you know, if anything, she reinforces Boaz.
Good. Yeah.
And then separates him from it. So it's like the right type of woman to hang around with.
Right. Right. I mean, it strikes me that it's like our modern conversation about intermarriage, right? Like we're so anxious about it, but like most of us don't really think there's anything wrong with non-Jewish women. It's some fear, or men, right? It's some fear that's the beginning of the end for your connection to your whole faith. If someone was coming over to your faith, well, then that wouldn't be a problem. We have an institution for that. Ruth is the paradigm of that institution. The fear is that you're going to be drawn away from the Torah. You're going to be drawn away from God. And all of these things, wealth and sex and power, they're all possibilities for ripping you away from what is the true wisdom? Fear of God and the Torah of your mother. Okay, that's really the worry at stake here. Okay. Okay, so as we come now to a close, we've considered wealth and we've considered women, and there, I would also say that I just mentioned the third in a sort of trio there, which is power itself. And there, I mean, there are lots of, I mean, the book is said to be written by a king, and there are a lot of, just like you'll see wealth throughout the book of Mishlei, and you'll see women and sexuality throughout the book of Mishlei, so you will see lots of depictions of a king in power. And some of them seem to apply, some of them don't. I won't say to have this book figured out, but here's one that reminds me of Shlomo. Kesem al sfatei melech. There's magic on the lips of a king. He cannot err in judgment. On his scales and balances are the Lord's. All the weights in the bag are his work. Wicked deeds are an abomination to kings, for the throne is established by righteousness. Truthful speech wins the favor of kings. They love those who speak honestly. The king's wrath is a messenger of death, but a wise man can appease it. The king's smile means life. His favor is like a rain cloud in spring. How much better to acquire wisdom and gold? To acquire understanding is preferable to silver. There's wealth again. The highway of the upright avoids evil. He who would preserve his life watches the way. Pride goes before the fall. Pride goes before ruin. Arrogance before failure. Better to be humble and among the lowly than to share spoils with the proud. So that reminds me of Shlomo. You can see like him there and unerring. Everything he says is just perfect and all of his judgments are right. We could find other places where Mishlei talks about King Kvod Melachim, Chakor Davar, the glory of a king is to investigate the bottom of the matter. But I just want to end with one last image of kings, because actually the book of Proverbs ends with an image of kings. But it's weird. It's strange. It's not Solomon. Suddenly there's a new king introduced. And this is the very last chapter of Mishle. And suddenly you get Divrei Lemuel, Melech Masa, the words of Lemuel, king of Masa. The words of Lemuel, king of Masa, with which his mother admonished him, Ma bri, uma bar bitni, ume bar nedarai. What, my son, and what of my womb, and what, son, of my vows? Do not give your strength to women, your vigor to those who destroy kings. And then she starts talking about wine. Wine is not for kings, O Lemuel, not for kings to drink, nor any strong drink for princes, lest they drink and forget what has been ordained. No drinking. No drinking. Now, women are in there, and power is in there, but wine is also in there, and I just want to remind us that wine was where we started with, like, the amorous drinking wine, your kisses being sweeter than wine in Song of Songs, right? So just interesting that, like, those two themes were associated there. And then, so, okay, but who is Lemuel? Who is this king that gets randomly introduced? In the very last chapter of Proverbs, well, of course, the Talmud in Sanhedrin reads Lemuel as just a code for Shlomo, and then sees this last interchange as an interchange between Shlomo and Bathsheba. So take a look at what they do with this, and we'll see what we have to say about this as we close. The words of Lemuel, king of Masa, with which his mother admonished him. Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan says, in the name of Shimon bar Yochai, this teaches that Solomon's mother bound him to a pillar, and she said to him, "What, my son, what, son of my womb, and what, son of my vows? Wine is not for kings, O Lemuel," and they're jumping back and forth here between the verses and then playing them out between Solomon and Bathsheba. "Not for kings to drink, nor any strong drink for princes." She said, "What have you to do with kings who drink wine and become intoxicated and say, 'Lama Lanuel?' Why do we need God?" So wine, which, you know, is related to romance, which dizzies the mind of a king, can lead you to all kinds of things, and so can wealth, and so can sex, and so can power itself. But ultimately, what leads you to is this idea that you will begin to say, "What do I need God for? What do I need God for?" That's really the fear behind it all, is that all of these temptations in and of themselves are, sure, kings have a lot of money, and sure, even kings have a lot of wives, but the problem is, are you getting to a point where you say, "I am so wise, so wealthy, so powerful, that I have no need to God, for God?" And so Rabbi Yitzchak says, "From where can it be learned that Solomon repented and admitted to his mother that she was justified in her rebukes? As it is written in the previous chapter, Kibar anochi mi'ish velo binat adam, and I am more foolish than a man, and I have not the understanding of man." This is maybe Torah Timecha. Like, this is really maybe the Torah that Solomon, at least as the rabbis imagining, is should have listened to. That maybe his mother was giving him that rebuke. That, "My goodness, I got you into this position, but you have taken yourself out of it by going crazy." And the metaphor for all of that is, in this case, not so much women, but wine, but drunkenness, being drunk with power, being drunk with the possibilities that you have when you're in a position of power to marry 1,000 women, to procure horses from Egypt, and ultimately to see yourself as acting independently of the source of it all, of God. There is this way in which Mishle is problematizing this woman, this figure of the woman, this foreign woman, but there's another way in which Mishle is creating this hyper, almost divine woman, which is wisdom itself personified. And so it makes sense that Mishle throughout is talking about your father and your mother and the musar of your father, which has to be balanced with the Torah of your mother. And there is some awareness that actually there's a good version of wealth, there's a good version of sex, there's a good version of power, and that is the side of wisdom. Wisdom can include all of these things, but you have to find the woman that you would recognize, the woman who Eshet Chayil Miyimtza, and that is in fact where the book ends. The book, the last chapter of the book begins with this strange conversation between Lemuel and his mother, and then launches into Eshet Chayil, and that's what the book of Proverbs ends with. A woman of valor. That's what, in some sense, wisdom will lead you to, not just the actual woman, but to a life of virtue and valor that includes wealth and sex and maybe status, but in a way that is still connected to your God and to your tradition.